Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned into my weekly wellness update podcast, bringing you the health news that you can use. Well, this week we have a number of interesting studies to go over, starting right out with an article I wrote called "Can Vitamin D Help Prevent H1N1 Swine Flu from Spreading?" Very interesting concept here. An article was published in the by John Cannell. He's kind of the he runs the Vitamin D Council, and vitamin D, of course, is his life. He did an article on the epidemiology of influenza, which is it's a very interesting article. And I did a report on this and related information. Essentially, what he is saying is that the mathematics involved with the sick person to well person transmission of the flu don't add up. And they don't add up, meaning that it's not just sick people spreading the H1N1 swine flu, or any flu for that matter. It is also most likely well people who are the prime reservoir of spreading of the virus. This is quite interesting. He cites some examples from earlier in time, in terms of the inability of scientists to prove that sick-to-well transmission is the primary means. But the bottom line of it is you have to have a certain timeline that's documented and a chain of events for sick-to-well transmission to be the key here, and it just does not add up. So it's kind of a mystery. It flies in the face of public health dogma. I mean, certainly you can get the flu from somebody who has it, but in order to have an actual outbreak of the flu that we have every season, something else has to be going on because of the rapid onset of it in so many people so fast. Well, one of his theories is that it's due to a lack of vitamin D, meaning that the inability or the deficiency of vitamin D in a population is what enables the flu to manifest in the winter, when, of course, vitamin D is lowest. This is consistent with a lot of new science showing that vitamin D is a big factor in immune function as a baseline nutrient, and that it certainly has a role in activating the immune defense and even in regulating how serious a flu infection would be in any person. And so we come to realize that we already know, because the American Cancer Society has been telling everybody to stay out of the sun for two decades, that over half Americans are deficient in vitamin D. It's kind of interesting. Over that past couple of decades, the flus themselves have been getting stronger, and the bugs themselves have been getting stronger progressively. And it could very well be due to a lack of vitamin D. At any rate, I review all of this in the article with all the references, and it's an interesting concept, but it just goes to show you that a society deficient in vitamin D, we know 70% of our kids are, and frankly deficient, and half the adults, is a great place for a flu to be in a petri dish of human beings. And it could very well be the well people who don't even realize they're sick who are the primary transmitters of this flu. Certainly that concept has been, the feasibility of it has been documented in animal studies. All right, another vitamin D story: breast cancer linked to low vitamin D. This is an ongoing area of research. We've seen some earlier studies out showing that vitamin D, which is more than a vitamin, vitamin D regulates genes, but we see from earlier studies that vitamin D is responsible for turning on tumor suppressor genes that reduce the likelihood of breast cancer. So we already know that. We know that overweight individuals are low in vitamin D. We know that overweight individuals are much more at risk for aggressive breast cancer. And so we have a situation here now where new research is being done. And what these researchers did is they analyzed the vitamin D levels of women who had breast cancer. And they came out with a recommendation that so many people were so deficient in vitamin D who had breast cancer that every single person who has breast cancer should be given vitamin D. Now, they were looking at it from the perspective of, well, you know, we're going to give them anti-estrogens. It's going to cause them to lose bone mass anyway, so we better make sure they're vitamin D adequate. These researchers were thinking of it from the perspective of trying to help their bones while they're going through cancer treatment. But my point would be, wow, women should do everything possible to make sure they are adequate in vitamin D up front, because this is a big factor in breast cancer risk. Neurontin and Lyrica are a death sentence for new brain synapses. This is just one of the most unbelievable stories that's come down the pike. I mean, I personally, if I, you can follow the FDA and its shenanigans, its scams, it's whatever you want to call them. You could follow this as a career and be overwhelmed working on the subject 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I just personally can't do that. But there are some of the stories that I can't help but follow. And some of the drugs I've been following for many years, Neurontin being one of them. Neurontin is the first drug that underwent a serious penalty for off-label promotion, meaning that in the early 90s, all of these brain meds went through rampant off-label promotion. The antidepressants, you know, the Prozacs, the Zolofts, these things were flagrantly marketed, as were many other drugs, in an off-label manner for all kinds of use. The goal is to get a drug on the market. Once the drug is on the market, then it's been approved for initial use. The FDA never demands follow-up studies for safety. The FDA has no idea if the drug it's approved is actually safe. All the FDA knows when it's approved any drug is that it has reasonable safety testing done that assures a try in the public with this drug. But they expect then to find out over the next number of years if it's safe or not. They really don't know. Well, they have dropped the ball on all safety testing of drugs, because normally the data shows that it's not safe. But that's why the drug companies don't like to do it. So the FDA doesn't make them, which is required by law. So we have, it would take at least 10 years of safety testing just to catch up to all the drugs that are on the market today, even the blockbusters, even drugs that have been going on for decades, like birth control pills. The side effects of these things are actually unknown. And so, but here's my point, is that the FDA, once the drug's on the market for a limited use, then the drug companies go and promote it for all kinds of uses that it was never proven to be a benefit for, but it will assist the symptoms thereof. And this, of course, is illegal. It's not illegal for doctors to use it this way, and that's the rub. So the drug companies build into the cost of marketing. This is now their new strategy. They build into the cost of marketing the drug all the off-label uses, and then the fine that they're likely to pay for illegally doing this. And this is how the business works. And so Neurontin was the first time. Neurontin is a brain drug originally approved for seizures, used for all kinds of things, pain, headaches, things that should have never been used for. And I've noted for years, as soon as someone goes on Neurontin, they say they feel better, just try to get off the stuff. It is so functionally addictive. Whatever it was helping is 10 times worse when you try to get off of it. It's just a nightmare. Now they've got the new super Neurontin called Lyrica, which they're actually, the FDA has approved for fibromyalgia. Now you got to understand, this is bizarre. If you look at the data that was submitted on Lyrica, which I have, or at least the primary study on its side effects, you'll see that at 12 months, the side effects of Lyrica are bad. At 24 months, the side effects of Lyrica are a nightmare. Every side effect gets worse the longer you use this stuff. And the FDA approves it anyway for fibromyalgia, which is a serious, metabolic problem that needs fixing, not drugging. So individuals go on the Lyrica to help with their pain, their wound-up nerves, and these kind of things, and it will suppress the symptoms. But, again, the problem is partly all the off-label uses. Lyrica is one of the four drugs that a subsidiary of Pfizer, Pfizer also owns Neurontin now, they paid $2.3 billion this past year here, beginning of this year, to settle their illegal off-label marketing of these drugs. These are huge fines. You think, wow, that would really stop them in their tracks. No, they build it into the cost of marketing. And the market that's created with all the off-label uses is still going on. And they're making way more than $2.3 billion. And they pass the cost along in the price of the drugs. It's just how the drug companies do business. Once they get their foot in the door of getting a drug on the market, they go out of their way to illegally market, injure people, and make money. Now, the reason I'm talking about Neurontin and Lyrica is because a new study just came out, and it showed for the very first time, how the drug works. They knew what receptors it bound to, but they didn't know what those receptors did, and they just knew that when it bound to these certain receptors in the brain, then the person seemed to calm down, maybe had less pain, less wound-up feeling. Well, that's fine that you can have a drug that suppresses symptoms, but what they now just found out is that the drug works by making it so that no new brain synapses can form. Unbelievable. You have to form new brain synapses to keep your head functioning and to keep your intelligence going and to have cognitive ability as you get older. So the long-term trade-off of the short-term suppression of symptoms is that you will have serious cognitive decline if you take these drugs for any length of time. That's Neurontin and Lyrica. Stay away from them like the plague. They are being recommended for all kinds of off-label things, even manic depressive. There are suicide, the FDA is right now pondering suicide for bipolar on Lyrica as a warning for its off-label use. But it's just sick. The FDA had no idea how these drugs work. There's this huge market for it, and these drugs cause brain damage. Very, very serious problem. The FDA twiddles its thumbs, completely corrupt organization, absolutely useless for what it should be doing in society. A pain in the rear end to anybody trying to help people. It's just a ludicrous outfit, and that's just that. All right, leptin problems linked to thyroid cancer. Thyroid cancer is the one cancer, interestingly, that is on the upswing compared to other cancers. So, a lot of public education on breast cancer and prostate cancer has helped curtail the rates somewhat. Obesity is going to drive them back out through the roof. But here we see the thyroid problems for the first time being linked to serious or leptin problems being linked to thyroid cancer. And what the researchers showed is that the leptin levels being elevated in the blood, which of course is leptin resistance caused by obesity or being overweight, it actually turns on receptors on thyroid cancer cells so that they grow. So now we're seeing that leptin is a major growth factor for thyroid cancer cells, helping to shed considerable light on this subject. I mean, we already know that the thyroid itself is very sensitive to many chemicals at a level that other tissues in the body are not, and many environmental chemicals are stressful and probable mutators for thyroid cells. So you have the perchlorate issue, you have fluoride issue, you even have chlorine, which all bind to the thyroid. And then you have all kinds of other chemicals in the environment that are very disruptive to metabolism because they interfere with thyroid function, likely increasing the risk for cell mutation. So this is a big issue. But here now, besides the chemical exposure, which would be one aspect of it, now we combine that with a population that's heading in the overweight direction, and that is why the thyroid cancer is such a problem. We now know probably the most likely reasons for that, and whether or not anybody does anything about it, again, the public health people, I mean, they're not going to want to clean up the environment, and they're inept at trying to get the population to lose weight, so we can just assume here that the rates of thyroid cancer will continue to skyrocket, except for those of you who understand the issue and take proactive steps to protect yourself against toxins and improve your leptin situation by following the leptin diet, and then you can be spared that fate. All right, poor flexibility is a sign of stiff arteries. Okay, so if you are over 40 and you are having trouble touching your toes, it is highly predictive that your arteries are getting stiff. The great low-tech tests. I like low-tech tests. I hate high-tech tests. You go in for these arterial scans for your calcium deposits, and you get this score, and now you're supposed to be panic-stricken if you have a bad score, and it proves virtually nothing. Because it just doesn't. Sometimes, it's data, but it's really costly data. And, all you got to do is put a tape measure around your stomach. If your stomach, if you multiply your stomach in inches by two, you shouldn't, your height shouldn't be more than that. In other words, if you're 6 feet tall, and your stomach shouldn't be more than 3 feet around, so 36 inches. Now, that's not a flat stomach, but it is a stomach that is once you go past a certain point, we know you start accumulating plaque because they've used the fancy test to prove that. There's a relationship between the size of your stomach and the hardening of your arteries. So now the scientists have proven there's a relationship between arteries getting stiff and how flexible you are. And in this study, they tested the ability to sit and reach, but it's basically the same as touching your toes. And the point being, you're either flexible or not, and if you're not very flexible, you can predict that your arteries are getting stiff. And the interesting thing is, you can make the opposite assumption, is that if you're flexible, your arteries probably aren't getting stiff. And that opens the door then to you stretching. Now, why would that work? Well, because when you stretch and you use your body, you turn on genes that are involved with regulating the process of recovery, rejuvenation of elastic tissues in your body. And so the process of doing things begets the health of those tissues. And a lot of times it's not just, say, stretching your, doing, toe touches or something, but any stretching of any kind will have a systemic effect on tissues around the body. So even though, say, you're stretching an arm or a leg, it's not just the arm or leg that benefits because you release compounds that your liver makes that goes into your blood, goes around to your rest of the tissues in your body, travels through your circulation, interacts with your arteries while it's on its way, and helps them be more flexible. So even though you're not stretching your arteries per se, the process of improving flexibility improves your arterial health. And that's good news because it opens the door for simple things you can do, simple things you can use as gauges for your health. To me, the low-tech approach is adequate for just about everything, along with what your symptoms mean. And they are more predictive than just about anything else. So you got to learn these things and learn how they work. And then it's a lot easier to take care of yourself. All right, 224,000 Americans died from poor hospital care from 2006 to 2008. That, for some odd reason, was not the study headline that was in the press release. That headline had to do with there being a 52% lower risk of dying at a top-rated hospital. So I'm the one that pulled the number out from their data and put it on the headline, which to me, I mean, that's news. That should be on the front page of the Washington Post, the New York Times, the USA Today, any paper that anybody reads. Talk about relevant. I mean, we have a healthcare debate going on here in this country, and quality of care is getting a pass. And, occasionally you hear concerns that, well, if all the good hospitals are made to, help so many people and the people who are paying out of pocket the economy of the situation gets out of whack, well, then maybe the good hospitals won't be good anymore, which might be the case. I don't know, but it could be. But my point here is that the top-rated hospitals compared to the average hospital, if you're at a top-rated hospital and you're an elderly individual on Medicare, you need some kind of an operation, you have a 52% lower risk of dying at a top-rated hospital. And compared to the worst hospitals, you have a 72% lower risk of dying. And when you run the numbers on this, it means that 74,000 people a year are dying from poor hospital care. That is just an absolutely mind-boggling number. 74,000 people from the care given at a hospital. Just the difference in the care. That's just unacceptable. And you're not going to save money, mind you. You're going to save lives, and you're going to help people live a better quality of life fixing this problem, but you're going to have to raise the quality of care across the board. And so maybe with reform of healthcare, we should start with the hospitals and then work on big pharma and the doctors and see where we can get rid of all the useless, needless use of drugs, which is a couple $100 billion a year now. And along with that, many, many injuries that land people in the hospital. And then work on the hospital care. I mean, we could save not only lives, but money and get people healthier. This is irregardless of what we do with the whole system. So, it's just interesting how this is being approached when obvious problems are not being addressed because it would offend constituent groups like doctors who would then be against the reform. I mean, if the public health people were out there, you know, attacking average hospitals as dangerous and that they needed reform, you'd have a, you know, you'd have doctors and hospitals objecting to that being the premise for reform. Yet they obviously need it. Okay, young people at risk for severe H1N1 swine flu. This is alarming, and it's worth paying attention to. Both the World Health Organization and the Center for Disease Control are pointing out that far more young people are winding up in the hospital in serious medical condition with this swine flu than any other flu. Already the number of children dying this flu season exceeds the number of children in an entire flu season. The number of people who have died from the swine flu under the age of 25 is, I believe, 50% of the deaths, and that's very abnormal. That's usually 10% of the deaths in a flu season, whereas it's, I believe, over the age of 65, it's very low percentage right now, and that's usually the highest percentage. So this flu is going after young people, and it is a significant issue. You want to pay attention to this. I've put all the data on the odds of it happening and all that kind of stuff in this article. But young people really do need to pay attention here. All right, bovine colostrum, an important immune support powerhouse. It should not be lost on anyone that the survival of the human race is in no doubt and in no small part based on the mother's passing immunity to her child. Children, little babies, don't have protection against whatever virus they may be coming into contact with, or some of the bacteria or whatnot. I mean, they're little kids, you know, they have to evolve a digestive system and an immune system. That takes work, it takes time. And if it's interfered with, then there are digestive problems, there are digestive illnesses, diarrhea, etc. And these rapidly move to respiratory problems. We know that children who do not get first milk colostrum have much higher risks for diarrhea diseases as well as respiratory infections, including the flu. So we know that colostrum is something very, very important, as is nursing in general throughout the whole time for a child. You know, these things, I mean, throughout the whole time, you know, certainly longer than 6 months isn't a bad idea, especially if you're going into a flu season and trying to consider whether or not you should continue nursing. My thing would be, yes, continue nursing until the problem with potential infection is over, because this is a serious issue. Here, anyway, we see with the bovine colostrum, there are a lot of new studies out on bovine colostrum. Bovine colostrum is, of course, much more available than a mom's colostrum for general use as dietary supplements or intake in society. In fact, there are many societies around the world that have used bovine colostrum traditionally for a very long time to support the health of their infants. There are many, many reports in the medical literature of this. Especially in third world countries where they find it absolutely essential for saving lives in, you know, malnourished areas. Bovine colostrum has proven to be very efficient. Now, of course, we have very sophisticated ways of making a consistent bovine colostrum product where the colostrum from hundreds of cows is mixed and standardized. And, of course, the better colostrum products don't have the synthetic growth hormone and whatnot. And you know, you can really get some good stuff. Anyway, there are a lot of studies now coming out. I mean, the colostrum itself, the bovine colostrum, has been shown to, it has components in it that directly kill bacteria. So it has a lot of bactericidal compounds in it. It has signaling compounds in it that talk to the frontline immune troops, tell them to get active. One of the most fascinating areas of research is that it's been shown, bovine colostrum has been shown to eliminate the bacterial toxin called lipopolysaccharide. And the LPS, or lipopolysaccharide, is what causes toxemia and overload of waste products from a bacterial infection. Not only does colostrum help get rid of that, it actually, other studies are showing now that colostrum repairs the intestinal barrier so well that bacteria themselves cannot translocate across the gut into the body. So It does this, and some of the new science also shows that it does it by reducing inflammation, actually turning down that central inflammatory gene known as NF-kappa-B. So we have a powerful frontline defense system here. And then we also have studies showing that colostrum boosts the higher power adaptive immune response. It raises interferon production, which is needed to fight viruses. In endurance athletes, a test was done with colostrum, and it showed that the inflammatory markers, especially that critically important TNFA, which has to be there to see a flu that you've never seen before, and it can't be there excessively as a baseline from inflammation. So athletes who inflame themselves from over-exercising often have elevated TNFA, which makes them at risk for getting sick. Well, when they take colostrum, that doesn't happen. It causes the TNFA to be normalized under the stress of excess activity, which is very interesting. And so some of the scientists researching all of these different properties of colostrum's ability to boost the adaptive immunity concluded that, quote, bovine colostrum could also represent an inexpensive therapeutic tool in prevention and treatment of several human microbial infections, including influenza. So that's very powerful data. Of course, it hasn't been studied with the H1N1 swine flu, but it is obviously what we have used as humans, the substance, which is very similar in the bovine colostrum. It's what we've used to survive against the enemies of the germ world throughout our time of evolution with them. So colostrum loaded with immune support nutrients, something to have as part of your ongoing program. All right, so we have here some questions coming in. And, of course, if you have a question for me, go ahead and email it, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. All right, Mary writes in and says, I have some skin care products with squalane in them, and you sell squalene for skin health. Is there a difference? Well, yes, Mary, both squalane and squalene are components of the sebaceous oils of the skin. Squalane is often used in cosmetic products because it is very good at helping the other components in the product to absorb deeper into the skin. That's why it's in there. The difference in squalene and squalane is significant in terms of biological activity. Squalene, which is the oil that we sell, is the it actually has 10 unsaturated bonds that are folded. The oil has these open points of chemical interaction in the body, but they're unlike a fatty acid, which is sort of unstable, like a fish oil, it has to be protected from oxidation. Squalene is much more stable because it folds into isoprenoid structures, which are signaling molecules that are vital to the health of cells. And so squalene is a nutritional oil with extreme biological activity. It helps to detoxify. It helps bring oxygen places in the body. It helps with dry skin, especially good in the wintertime, and that's why we use it. It is different than squalane. Squalane doesn't have any unsaturated bonds, so in a sense, it's more stable in the fact that it has no ability to interact with anything, so it's not going to oxidize under really almost any condition, but it also doesn't do anything, so except it is a good transporter of cosmetic nutrients into deeper layers of the skin. So that's why it's used in those kind of products, Mary. Not something you take orally. All right, Christina says, I've become very disconcerted when I heard on the news that concussions result in dementia in later life. At 15, I was in a serious accident, sustained a concussion with a fractured skull. I healed quickly and had no measurable damage. For 42 years, I've not had a problem with brain health. As an ovo-vegetarian, for many years, I have consistently worked to improve my health. As a teacher, I work with handicapped high school students who have suffered brain injuries. What is the outlook for me and for those who, unlike me, have had damage? In this news hype, like most of the things put out by the American medical monopolies? Or is this news hype, like most of the things put out by American medical monopolies? Or is it meant to address those with repeated concussions, as in sports, etc.? Well, Christine, a very good question. Certainly, any injury, no matter what it is, earlier in your life would be a weak spot. So if you injure a knee or injure an ankle, that can come back and haunt you a little bit later in life. Now, maybe that knee is achy or the ankle gives you problems, and so it is with brain injuries. You've been fortunate in that you've taken pretty good care of yourself. We now know that accumulated small brain injury is going on a daily basis for most Americans over the age of 40 who aren't managing stress well and managing inflammation. The science is highly predictive that brain tangles, plaques in the brain start forming as an inability to recover from the inflammation in the brain in the majority of Americans, whether they've had a concussion or not. And it's just accumulated damage that goes on for many years before you start seeing, you know, memory problems, cognitive decline, dementia, and then Alzheimer. So, yes, it is true that concussions would be major insults to the brain structure, but that doesn't mean you can't fully recover from one. And so, you know, it's going to be relative to the person's long-term health trend. In your situation, you've obviously done a lot to take care of yourself. Not such an issue. It's there in your history, but not such an issue. For others who basically haven't corrected the damage and haven't managed stress well and have concussion histories, it's a big issue. I mean, we know that football players, for example, as you're saying here with repeated concussions in sports, football players have early onset Alzheimer's and major dementia problems at much earlier than the average from all of their multiple brain injuries. I mean, this isn't, you know, rocket science. I mean, as you pound the head too many times, and you're going to have trouble in later life. Muhammad Ali would be an example of somebody who certainly had some problems later after taking quite a lot of trauma to the head. At any rate, in your situation, if you keep managing your health, and for everyone in general, if they manage inflammation on an ongoing basis and their checkbook is balancing week in and week out and month in and month out in terms of their wear and tear trend, you are going to minimize brain injury. And if you do things on the positive side to stimulate new brain cells, such as exercising aerobically, using the nutrients that help to build brain cells, challenging your brain by learning new activities, both mentally and physically, learning new physical skills and mental skills, you will build new brain networks and you will compensate for any weak spot. So there's a lot people can do to rejuvenate and regenerate, and having a lifelong strategy of that is far better than deciding to take it up at the age of 65 when you're starting to notice you don't remember things. All right, Judy says, in light of the fact that the FDA is halting sales of natural desiccated thyroid, including Armour, could you recommend other products besides Thyroid Helper, iodine, etc., for those of us who are hypothyroid and don't want drugs? I had a terrible reaction to Synthroid a couple of years ago and will not trust the drugs any longer. Well, Judy, I don't believe that. I think there's a shortage of Armour Thyroid. It certainly hasn't been taken off the market. I think a couple of the companies making it are not able to anymore. There is Westroid, and I think there's a couple others. RLC, I believe, is the manufacturer of those that are in the same kind of category as Armour Thyroid. And you can certainly, if your pharmacist is saying they don't have it anymore, go find another pharmacist. Go to a compounding pharmacist if you need to. You can get these things. They're not available. And when you do get a prescription, you might ask your doctor for a one-year prescription of this, because I've always recommended that for years anyway, because that way you can, whatever dose you're getting, and they vary a little bit from batch to batch, at least you're getting the same thing for a year, so you have a little bit better ability to regulate the amount, Judy. Cheryl says, I have narcolepsy, and we are supposed to have 50% less leptin than normals. Is there a natural way of obtaining more leptin or orexin to benefit from your diet? Kind of stuck in hibernating bear mode, not able to lose much with less leptin. Well, yes, Cheryl, some people with narcolepsy, which, of course, narcolepsy means you have sleep attacks during the day. And in other words, the system doesn't have the stimulus to come on. That has been associated with less leptin, although not less leptin in the nervous system, but less leptin in the blood, which does reflect a certain kind of hibernation. It's a different problem than a lot of people have. But the issue of orexin, which are also called hypocretins, which are the stimulus to search for food, really. But they're there to activate and wake your head up. Those are what you really don't have, and you make a point of that. So, you know, what can you do? Well, you don't have any margin for error with leptin, so you got to follow the leptin diet, number one. Number two, you've got to stimulate adrenaline going through your brain to try to kick on orexin-related circuits. So the way to do that is with vigorous short-duration exercise. I would recommend 5 to 10 minute bursts of whatever gets you huffing and puffing, walking up and down stairs really fast, jumping jacks, deep knee bends, up and down things, vertical things, things that are not aerobic, you know, not a walk. You can walk, certainly, but aerobic exercise will not stimulate adrenaline and thus hypocretin orexin activation, which you need. So you need to stimulate and pump the blood and get this orexin going. And because the circuitry is seemingly not there, whether that's a gene discrepancy or just something that's happening for some reason, you need to try to put the brain circuitry back in place. So building brain cells, pantothene, DHA, phosphatidylserine, many, many things I talk about for building brain cells. You might live on a blueberry diet. I mean, these things help stimulate the BDNF that activates new brain connections. You need to develop the circuitry relating to brain stimulation. So part exercise, part nutrients. Good luck. Gina, my 7-year-old son needs help focusing. What do you recommend? Well, for a 7-year-old, you're a little bit limited. Sometimes they swallow vitamins, sometimes they don't. We have the smaller DHA capsules. It's really hard to get kids to eat fish oil, so the small capsules are pretty easy to swallow. You can put them on a spoon with some yogurt or applesauce, and they'll slide right down. But the DHA is very good. I like the PIC 50, the grapeseed extract. You can pull, that's a small capsule, but you can also pull it apart and mix it in almost anything. There's no limit to what you can do. If you look at my sections on brain health, I mean, any of those supplements can be given to a 7-year-old and can be very, very helpful, Gina. So there's lots of options for you. Tracy, are there any supplements that you can recommend for someone who suffers from Meniere's disease? Well, Meniere's disease, Meniere's, of course, is related to, dizziness, sometimes the ringing in the ears. The most recent science on Meniere's that they were able to show as being a consistent problem is it is a lymph problem where the lymph pressure backs up onto the ear and then lymph droplets of fluid push in and mix with the fluid that's in the inner ear and contaminate it. That's their newest theory or their latest theory. And so, kind of an underlying lymph problem, which I talk about quite a lot, you know, using the Immune Plus to help clear that out. Repair Plus would be good. And, anything that's connective tissue-like, say Cardio Plus with the grapeseed extract, for example, that would help heal the little membrane in there that's getting compromised would be a good idea. So you with Meniere's are a more advanced problem. You not only have to get rid of the lymph pressure, but you have to heal the membrane in the ear. You got to do both. But those would be things to work on, Tracy. Phyllis says, I've searched over 7 years for information about Marfan syndrome, a connective tissue disorder, but never found helpful information. What supplement, if any, would you advise for this cardiovascular disease? Well, Marfan syndrome is a problem. You see this every now and then with individuals. They normally have longer bones. It's basically an excessive growth problem, but it's inappropriate, and it does affect the aorta in the heart. Unfortunately, Phyllis, it is a genetic problem, and there's no specific nutrient that changes Marfan syndrome. So whenever you have a condition that is whatever it is, and then you have body areas associated with that you might call weak spots that are associated with whatever the medical problem is, your use of nutrition isn't, say, to cure or prevent Marfan syndrome. Your use of nutrition is to support the health of those weakened or potential weak spots as best you can and hope for the best, which is a lot that you may be able to do with that. So for the heart itself, of course, you have excellent nutritional support. You've got CoQ10, you've got magnesium. You've got like the Cardio Helper with the grapeseed extract, the resveratrol, these kind of things. Our cardiovascular health topic page has many nutrients listed there that are good for heart health. And you have to think of this in terms of, okay, I have to just support the heart as best I can because that's a weak spot. And therein, you have a lot of things you can do. And, you know, like I said, they're not going to change the genetic problem of Marfan syndrome. But what you're trying to do is provide health to a weak spot as best you can. And it is my opinion that you can do a lot with that, not only with Marfan syndrome, but for any kind of problem anybody has that is a gene problem or, you know, an injury or something, you know, where you're not just dealing with quote unquote normal function, you're dealing with something that is not functioning right, either because of, you know, accident, injury, or some kind of damage, or from some genetic related issue. And there's lots of these things around, and they're just the way the deck was dealt in some ways. There's not much you can do about them, but you can support whatever the problem is, and lots of times get some relief and certainly some betterment in the health, certainly with the heart. There's lots of things you can do to assist the heart. Lucia from Brazil writes in and says, 2 months ago, I had a case of vitreous detachment with the accompanying flashes, floaters, and blurred vision. The eye doctor I went to see told me this is a very common condition for people my age, which is 65, and that there is nothing that can be done to clear the floaters or to bring the vitreous back in place. Not satisfied with this prospect, I began taking liquid collagen, just in case, because this is one element in the vitreous. I'm also drinking horsetail tea because there are some indications for the condition. Is there any conclusive evidence that vitamin B6 is a triggering factor for posterior vitreous detachment? Well, what would be your vision on this topic? There was one study, Lucio, on vitamin B6, which proved nothing. It was a sort of an associative study, and it found that in women before menopause, they had a bit of an increased risk for this vitreous detachment if their B6 levels were higher, but that disappeared after menopause, and there was no data on men. So there's certainly no conclusive evidence on that, nothing that I would be avoiding vitamin B6 on, that's for sure. Vitamin B6 is critically important for lots of things in your body. As to your problem, when you've just had a problem where you get a lot of floaters or blurriness of vision, your ability to change that back and get a lot of resolution is best accomplished soon thereafter, meaning that within the first couple of months, you're going to get the most benefit. You might get some slow improvement over the period of 6 months to a year with whatever you're doing, but your goal is stabilizing your eye. Your eye needs a lot of antioxidants, and it needs connective tissue support things. So liquid collagen, you know, I'm not sure what product you're using, but that's not a bad idea. We use hyaluronic acid a lot. The product Cardio Helper, which has the grapeseed extract in it, grapeseed extract will bind to tattered tissues and increase their tensile strength. There was a study a number of years ago when they were doing the original research in France for the, you know, selling the grapeseed extract as a medication in France, which was how it was originally done, where they showed that grapeseed extract could increase the tensile strength of collagen 21 times. So your body has a choice when something's injured, either cart it off or try to repair it. So grapeseed extract is a powerful strengthener of collagen connective tissue and would be really good for any kind of an eye issue. The tocotrienol form of vitamin E is amazing for eyes. I've had really good results with that in helping the eye. The eyes just need a lot of antioxidants. And so vitamin E, especially the tocotrienols, lipoic acid is very good. And then connective tissue healers, hyaluronic acid and the grapeseed extract. And then sometimes, you know, you just got to get down the general burden of inflammation. You don't know what triggered this. Was it high stress? Was it wear and tear? Weren't you sleeping well? Were you exposed to chemicals? What happens, and the main triggering events for these things lots of times is a condition of toxicity following a period of illness, following, you know, just drinking too much. I mean, there's lots of things that could have triggered it that fall under the toxic or inflammatory category. So a lot of times a liver support blood cleaner like our Daily Balancer, which has Silymarin and lipoic acid in it, these things are very good at clearing this out. And if you get whatever was kind of punching the eye in the nose under control and then stabilize the eye structure, you can see a significant improvement in this kind of blurriness and floaters and stuff, and even reattachment of the vitreous membrane, strengthening it. That's all doable. It's not beyond the realm of possibility because it's normal to have this working properly. So to say, for a doctor to say, well, this doesn't improve, the doctor's just assuming that your body doesn't know how to fix itself. And that, of course, is kind of a silly assumption for a doctor. Because, you know, really, being a doctor, it's kind of an art form, and you're trying to turn on the innate healing properties, even if you're just using the placebo effect. You're doing anything you can to get the person to think that they can heal. So, you know, you have lots of options, Lucio, and thanks for writing in. All right, that's it for the questions this week. If you have a question to me, please email it, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. Have a great week, and I'll be back next week, of course, with more of your questions and more health news. Take care.
The Weekly Wellness Update podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated, copyright 2008, all rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.